What does climate change have to do with your personal freedom? Find out next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy and the Executive Director of Camp American. And today's show is essentially going to be the second part of something we ran much earlier called Rescuing a Broken America by Dr. Michael Kaufman. It was a presentation at the 2010 Camp American. This is the second half. This comes from Dr. Michael Kaufman's book, Rescuing a Broken America. And Dr. Michael Kaufman is an environmental scientist who has interests also in the connection between global warming, climate science, climate change, and government activity that would restrict your freedom. It's a very short lecture. It's only an hour long, and he basically is going to talk about the connection with all those things. So pay attention. This is kind of whirlwind. It's very short, and in order to get it all in, we're going to have to get to it. So this is Dr. Michael Kaufman.
Okay, when we wound up just before lunch, I mentioned that we're going to be talking about something about property rights and community sustainability and so forth. I'm going to skip over that. We just don't have time for it. It was supposed to be done this morning, and it went too long. And I was going to be talking about, one of the things I was going to be talking about was the Biodiversity Treaty. And for those of you who were here 2 years ago, I did go into that in quite good detail and how God used us to be able to stop that treaty an hour before it was to be ratified. If you're new to the camp since then, maybe I'll be invited back and I'll do it next year. That's a strong plug. I'm going to talk about primarily global warming and then how you can use some constitutional language that's built into almost every state and federal law that you can use to protect your community. First, talking about global warming, it's a fraud. As I indicated this morning, I was doing multi-million dollar research into this effort back in the late 80s and 90s, and there wasn't any science to really back up the fact that man was causing it. We were having global warming. But there was all kinds of evidence to suggest that man did not have anything to do with it. And there's even less evidence now. In fact, 31,000 scientists across America have signed a petition, 9,000 of which are actual PhDs, that said that there is no convincing scientific evidence that human release of carbon dioxide, methane, or other greenhouse gases is causing or will, in the foreseeable future, cause catastrophic heating of the Earth's atmosphere and disruption of the Earth's climate. 31,000 scientists, and you hear this, there's just a strong consensus within the scientific community. It just doesn't exist. In fact, if there was a poll taken today, I think you would find that more than well over half of the climate scientists themselves would say that man probably is not causing it.
Former Vice President Al Gore's Academy Award has propelled him to the center stage on the global warming issue. As he says, he hopes his movie, The Inconvenient Truth, is seen by everyone so that they are convinced we are truly facing a planetary crisis that requires a global response and administration. But just how factual is his video? The major premise of The Inconvenient Truth is that carbon dioxide is the major greenhouse gas that drives the temperature of the Earth.
They can go back 650,000 years. Here's what the temperature has been on our Earth. The relationship is actually very complicated. When there is more carbon dioxide, the temperature gets warmer because it traps more heat from the sun inside.
Now, how would you interpret this? First of all, how many have actually seen this video? Not that many, I'm surprised. Most of you are probably homeschooled, is that right? Because otherwise you would have seen it in your public school systems at least a dozen times by now. But how many, what is that telling you? What message is he conveying? Yes. Right. That CO2 is highly correlated with temperature and somehow is related to causing the temperature to increase and decrease. That's the message that you come away with. Now, let's go to the IPCC report. This is the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They have the same set of graphs. And notice the two graphs are separated, just like Al Gore's was. And if you were to superimpose them, what you will find is that changes in temperature always precedes changes in carbon dioxide. Always. By anywhere from 200 to 800 years. So if there is a cause and effect relationship, it's always that that temperature changes cause changes in carbon dioxide. Why? Very simple. We've known this for centuries. Cold water can hold more carbon dioxide than warm water. And when the planet begins to heat up, it releases carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and carbon dioxide goes up a couple hundred years after the temperature goes up, and the oceans warm up. When the Earth cools and the oceans begin to cool, it absorbs more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. We have known that simple relationship for at least 100 years. Yes?
How can they trace the temperatures back that far?
Okay, that's a good question, and you cannot be really sure about this, but what they've done is they've used ice cores that go back hundreds of thousands of years. And in those ice cores, there are little atmospheric molecules trapped, little bubbles trapped of air in that ice. And they are able to measure the amount of CO2, and based on some other deterioration of radioactive material, determine what the relative temperature was at that point. And while I think it's probably fairly accurate for a trend, I would not guarantee you that that's exactly the levels of carbon dioxide or temperature at that particular point in time. But I think they're probably relatively good for trends. The point being that while Al Gore doesn't say that temperature causes, carbon dioxide causes temperature to change, that's definitely the impression that he gives the audience. And this has been shown in every public school in America, probably in every grade from about the sixth grade on.
It wasn't in my public school.
It was not. Good, good. Well, I have this DVD if you're interested. It's actually designed for high school use, but any audience, actually. And it's even got lesson plans for your teacher or if you're homeschooled. It's designed to confront Al Gore's false claims. Another thing that they keep coming back to is that these 20 climate models always show that man is going to cause warming. But these climate models are all grossly wrong. It's not because the scientists that are creating them and so forth are necessarily trying to make them wrong, but they're using the wrong assumptions, and I'll explain why. Now, for those of you who were here 2 years ago, you saw this particular graph, at least I think you did. And what this shows is, just so that you get oriented, the equator is up and down the middle. The North Pole is to the left. The South Pole is to the right. This is the latitude down at the bottom part of the graph, and the height above the Earth's surface on the right-hand side of the graph, or vertical. So what you're seeing here is that the models show, every single one of them, show that the greatest warming is going to be occurring within the equatorial regions, from 30 degrees north to 30 degrees south, at an elevation of about 6 to 12, 14 kilometers in elevation. Now, why is that? Why would carbon dioxide cause that phenomenon to happen? Well, it doesn't, because carbon dioxide has almost no influence on Earth's temperature. And every climate scientist knows this, everyone. But that's not what you've heard, is it? What they believe happens is that there's only two small ranges within the wavelength of the solar emissions that carbon dioxide actually absorbs, the electromagnetic spectrum. And those two things are saturated. You can add 10 times more carbon dioxide and you'll get very little impact on the Earth's temperature because it's already saturated. But they do estimate that if you were to double the amount of carbon dioxide, it will probably cause the Earth to warm up about a half a degree. Maybe 75 hundredths of a degree. And what that does then, they say, is that it actually causes an increase in the number of thunderstorms, especially in the equatorial regions. Now, with the one thing with thunderstorms is it takes warm moist air from the surface and pulls it up into the upper atmosphere to 30 to 40, 50,000 feet. So you're pumping water vapor in the upper atmosphere when those Thunderstorms decay, it leaves thin cirrus clouds and high relative humidity. Now, water vapor accounts for as much as 77% of all greenhouse gas effects on planet Earth. Carbon dioxide itself, maybe 9 to 25%. So a little bit of increase in temperature causes more moisture to move up into the upper atmosphere, forming the thin cirrus clouds, more water vapor, and therefore it's the water vapor and those thin clouds that trap the heat of the Earth, not carbon dioxide. And every climate model has that built into it, every single one of them. The problem with that is that if you were to actually look at the warming over the last 50 years, what you find is that there is no warming in the polar or in the equatorial regions. In fact, there is a slight cooling. In other words, the actual temperatures do not collaborate the predictions of the models because the models are wrong. Now, they say there is a positive feedback from a little bit of carbon dioxide increasing the water vapor, and therefore the Earth's temperature causes that positive feedback. But the science is showing that there is probably either a neutral feedback or a negative feedback. And all these models are based on the wrong assumptions. So if you compare the actual to the projected with these models, the two do not agree, period. The models are wrong, but they're not going to tell you that. You know, several of the speakers before us indicate that these people are liars. Well, that's not coming through in any sound.
And half of West Antarctica broke up and melted. This is what would happen to the sea level in Florida. This is what would happen to San Francisco Bay. A lot of people live in these areas. The Netherlands, one of the low countries. Absolutely devastating. The area around Beijing that's home to tens of millions of people. Even worse.
Now, if you were a 6 or 7 year old watching this in your classroom, what would be your reaction? Fear. In fact, there's a lot of reports coming out now that this movie has engendered tremendous fear within our younger school children. It's absolutely criminal that this movie is being shown. Notice that he said that if half of Antarctica and half of the Greenland ice cap were to melt, you'd have this kind of problem. He didn't say it was going to happen. He just said if. And he basically says that the western and the northern part of Antarctica with the Antarctic Peninsula are melting. Well, there's some evidence of this, not as much as he claims. Most of the ice breakup and so forth has occurred in the Antarctic Peninsula. Well, why? You see this practically every year. You didn't see it this year, but this was in 2008. Notice in the upper right-hand corner, you have an intact ice shelf on the 28th of February. The 29th of February, it begins to decay. And on the March 8th, a week later, it is disintegrated. And this was on the evening news every day for 5 days. And this was evidence of global warming. Is it? This is from NOAA, National Oceanographic and what administration? Atmospheric Administration. And they basically have found that it's not Antarctica that's getting warmer. In fact, Antarctica is getting colder. It's the oceans around the east or the west half up to Antarctic Peninsula that is getting warmer. The oceans, not the continent. Now, what's causing the oceans to warm up? Well, there is no logical explanation except that they're finding that these are very, very active geologic volcanic areas with a lot of vents. And it appears that the last 30 years since the eruption of Mount Erebus that It's become much more volcanically active, and as a consequence, is warming the oceans. It has nothing to do with global warming. Now, last winter in the South, this is the heart of their winter. The ice extent for Antarctica was probably, it was record levels. It was equal to the 2007 extent, which was a record. But the two things I want you to show is the areas where it was supposedly warming in the oceans that we just saw a moment ago, that's where the ice is the thinnest. It's the oceans. And even that warmer ocean, you still had ice being formed around the continent in the dead of winter. Record levels of ice. What about Antarctica? Well, the Vikings colonized, settled in Greenland, about 900 AD, and were thriving by 1200 AD during what we call the medieval climate optimum. Al Gore said that they're having major melting. This was in 2005, and he was correct, except the red areas is where they didn't used to have ice back when the Vikings were colonizing Greenland. I'm going to tell you a little story. It's quite interesting, fascinating, as a matter of fact. In 1942, a squadron of B-17s and P-38s were flown, brand new planes, were flown from the United States to England for the war. They took off from Greenland, were supposed to refuel in Iceland before they landed in England. They got to Iceland, it was fogged in, they could not land, so they turned back to Greenland. By that time, Greenland was fogged in. They had nowhere to go. They had to land on the Greenland ice cap. They survived. There wasn't any loss of life or anything, but the planes obviously stayed there. In 1982, a team gathered enough money to start looking for these planes. They couldn't find them. They knew exactly where they were, had landed, but they could not find them. Finally, after 10 years worth of searching, they found them. And this is one of the P-38s, 250 feet below the ice surface. That's how much ice has accumulated above these planes. The ice cap is not melting. It's still increasing. That plane that you see right there was disassembled, actually hauled up piece by piece, and reconstructed, and it's now flying. It's called the Glacier Girl. It's a fascinating story. You can see it on the History Channel if you have interest in this. It really is quite interesting. Now, here we have the current sea level. The IPCC says it's going to warm or to increase in levels is about 2 feet in the next 100 years. Even that's too much. But Al Gore says 20 feet. Is he wrong in what he said? No, he was technically correct. He said if half of the Antarctic ice cap and half of the Greenland ice cap were to melt, the oceans would rise 20 feet, which is probably true. I haven't calculated, but it's probably true. Well, what are the chances of that much ice melting? Zero. It's been warmer 24 times in the past 10,000 years than it is right now, by at least a half a degree. 8 of those times, it's been warmer by 2 to 6 degrees above what it is right now. And the Greenland ice cap didn't disappear, and the Antarctic ice cap did not disappear. The chances of that happening are zero. And yet, to watch his video, you would come away with the idea that this is a real threat to humanity, to literally tens and hundreds of millions of people that live on coastlines. It is criminal. In fact, it's so bad that the British High Court ruled against the video being shown in their public school systems because it has so much error in it, and they've labeled it a propaganda film. And yet it's still being shown in American classrooms. Well, if CO2 or carbon dioxide is not causing global warming, what is? There's one or two things that it could possibly be. If we plot out solar radiation or the length of the solar cycle is 11 years on the average. If it's longer, it's usually cooler. If it's shorter, it's usually warmer. And there is a good correlation, about 80% correlation. Is it the sun? Well, the Danish Solar Institute has found that there's a strong correlation between cosmic radiation coming from these supernovae out in our galaxy. When that cosmic radiation finally reaches the Earth's surface, it ionizes. And when it ionizes, it creates water droplets and clouds. And so you have more low elevation clouds. Now, I just got through saying that high elevation, thin high elevation clouds can trap heat. Low elevation clouds are very reflective. And up to 90%, usually around 60%, of the solar radiation that's incoming will reflect off the top of those clouds back out into space. It never reaches the Earth's surface. The Earth's surface cools when you have cosmic radiation. You have more cosmic radiation when you have a very quiet sun like we have had the last 7 years. And there is a very good correlation between cosmic radiation and cloudiness around the Earth's surface, about a 96% correlation. But when the sun becomes very active, and you have a lot of solar flares, coronal mass ejections, that type of thing, what happens is that you get what is called solar winds, plasma, that is emitted from these things, strikes the Earth's surface, the Earth's magnetic field protects the Earth, but the solar winds themselves dampen the effects of cosmic radiation. So looking at it pictorially, what we find is that when the sun is very quiet, a lot of cosmic radiation hits the Earth's surface, causing cloudiness and a cooling Earth, and when it becomes more active, every 11 years, the solar winds protect the Earth, and there is much less cosmic radiation entering the Earth's atmosphere, fewer clouds being formed, more solar radiation entering and striking the Earth's surface and warming the Earth. And there's a good correlation with this. Can't prove cause and effect, but there is a good correlation. Now, this last solar cycle that was over about 2007, solar cycle 23, was supposed to start 2.5 years ago. It didn't. And what we saw, or what should have happened, is that we should be very close to the peak now of solar activity. But this is what's happened. It's 2.5 years late. And when you have a longer solar cycle, that means more cosmic radiation and a cooling planet. Guess what we had last winter? Surprise, surprise. Now, the Russians have been following this more than we have. Now, almost all of our research money into this has gone into carbon dioxide warming, very little into anything else, because we predetermined that carbon dioxide is the cause of global warming. But the Russians and the Danish are not tricked into that. And the Russians have been following this solar radiation very closely. They have an experiment now being set up on the space station. And when that's over in a couple years, they're going to have some conclusive evidence one way or the other. But they're now predicting that we're entering into another very cold, 200-year cold cycle. I hope they're wrong. Because if they're right, that means crop failures, starvation, pestilence, like it did in around the 1700 when we had the little ice age. I haven't showed you that, and I'll show you in a minute. Now, there is one other factor that could be causing this, and it's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation or the Atlantic Muttle Decadal Oscillation. If you look at these graphs, what you will find that this is the North Pole in both of these, and the United States is down here. So just get yourself oriented. What happens is that under a positive oscillation, you have, if you look at the bottom of this graph, much warmer temperatures, milder temperatures across the U.S., and we've had that the last 30 years. In the late 1990s, that switched to the colder phase that we're now deeply into, and where you have major cold outbreaks in the center part of the United States and Europe and so forth, and a cooling Earth. In fact, this correlation is so good that there's an 86 or 85% correlation. Now, is it the sun or is it these oscillations? Scientists are debating this right now that are not stuck on the carbon dioxide theory. They don't know. It could be a combination of both. It could be the sun is driving the ocean oscillations. We just don't know. But it's certainly not carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide correlation is about 44%, half of what either the sun or the ocean oscillations are giving us. It's just not happening. Now, there has been tremendous pseudoscience, what we call false science, and data fraud going on with this whole debate for the last 25 years. If you look at over 100, about 150 studies, they show that the Earth cooled around 1700 to 1850 AD. And we have been warming up since that time. And the warming that we're seeing today, or at least through the 1990s, was nothing more than a continuation of the warming from the Little Ice Age that occurred 300 years ago. You look back, in fact, we have historical evidence of this as well. Every year they had ice parties along on the Thames River in London. The Thames River never freezes over anymore. And the canals of Holland, Hans Christian Andersen, talking about skating on the canals, they don't freeze over anymore. But that was around the 1700-1800 period. It was real. There's no question that the Little Ice Age was real. Then if you look back further, you'll see the Little Ice Age and what is called the medieval climate optimum, where it was about a degree and a half to 2 degrees warmer than it is right now. And then the Holocene optimums, which were a couple degrees warmer than even that. So we've had warm periods in the past. What we're seeing now is nothing unusual. And this is the result of literally hundreds and hundreds of research studies. Then in 1989 comes this graph, made up of tree rings. It's called a hockey stick graph, shaped like a hockey stick. And it shows basically a flat temperature for over 1,000 years, no medieval climate optimum, no Little Ice Age, gone. And all of a sudden, the Earth's temperature is skyrocketing in the latter half of the 20th century. That was the centerpiece of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report in 2001. It was listed 7 times in that report as the smoking gun to prove man-caused global warming. There was two people in Canada, two scientists, by the name of Stephen McIntyre and McKittrick, like Tim McKittrick or something like that, that were questioning this. The writer of this hockey stick, by the name of Dr. Michael Mann at University of Pennsylvania, refused to give them the data that he used to construct this. However, they were able to duplicate it in 2004, and they found that the equations used to construct this were totally wrong. In fact, in 2009, just this last fall, what happened was that they actually got the data set that Michael Mann used and found out that that steep curve was not made from the same data that they'd done the last previous 1,000 years from, because the tree ring data started to show that the temperature was going down, not up. So he deleted the tree ring data and substituted in the actual data from the weather stations around the world, which have problems of their own. He literally, we're comparing apples to oranges. And finally, when he got the full data set and put it in, there was no warming whatsoever. And yet, the hockey stick continues to be used today. It's been proved 100 times that it's false. And yet, it's still being used today. Now, you probably heard of the ClimateGate email scandal from the University of East Anglia, the Climatic Research Center. There are thousands of these emails, but this is just one. He says, I've just completed Dr. Michael Mann, the guy that did the hockey stick, nature trick of adding in the real temperatures to each series for the last 20 years, i.e. from 1981 onwards and from 1961 for Keith's data to hide the decline. Now, it's the CRU, this climatic research unit, that provides most of the data for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's reports. And they're obviously cooking the books. The other thing that they do not consider is what's called the heat island effect. And I'll just give you a quick overview of this. This is Orange County Airport in Southern California. I was born and raised in that area. I went by this airport probably a dozen times this summer going to the beach, Newport Beach. It was barren and desolate. There wasn't a building in sight. This is what it looked like in the 1970s. You can begin to, it was expanded into a national airport, and commercial development began to happen around it. By the 1990s, it was fully developed, a lot of asphalt and so forth. This has happened basically in every major city in the world. The measuring stations used to be out in the rural areas, and the city grew up around them. Now, when you start laying asphalt out with asphalt roofs and so forth, what's going to happen? Hey, guys, what happens when you walk across hot asphalt? It gets hot. And the average temperature for that city will raise up to 10 to 12 degrees. And yet, they have not corrected the data in the global data set. They have tried to do that for the U.S. data set, but let me just show you a little bit. Just to show that evidence, here in the top photo is the Atlanta International Airport in the bottom there with natural color. With infrared color, you can see that the temperature is almost 10 degrees warmer. It's real. It's a heat island effect, and it's not compensated for in the global data set. If you look in the United States after the so-called corrected data, the top graph, and that's for the cities and the U.S. rural temperatures, you're still getting divergence, even with the corrected data. Is this heat island? Very likely. And yet, that is still influencing all the graphs that you see that the so-called proving that man is causing global warming. It has nothing to do with global warming. Back to the emails. The two MMs, Stephen McIntyre and Ross McKittrick, have been after the CRU data, station data, for years. If they ever hear that there is a Freedom of Information Act now in the UK, I think I will, this is the director of the CRU speaking, or writing, I'll delete the file rather than send it to anyone. We also have a Data Protection Act, which I will hide behind. Now, why is he so protective of the raw data? Because he will not let access to that raw data to any other scientist in the world. You have to ask why. He has massaged, summarized, and so forth these data sets, and that's what's being used, which is okay, because the data sets have a lot of errors and so forth in them that need to be cleaned up. But it's how you clean them up that makes all the difference in the world, and the only way that they can be validated is by other scientists repeating the process. And he refuses to give the data set to anyone else. In 2009, he was forced by the British courts to release the data. And he deleted it rather than giving it out. That's how bad this whole thing is. They have no evidence whatsoever to support their theory. Now, In January, on January 17th, the world found out that in 2007 IPCC report that was reporting that the Himalayan glaciers were going to disappear by the year 2035 was wrong. They basically found out that the so-called report was based upon a World Wildlife Fund report whose author was citing some offhand comment made by an Indian scientist that was just joking about the Himalayan ice cap or glaciers disappearing by 2035. He never intended to be serious about this, but yet it made it into the IPCC report. It had no basis whatsoever. Totally false. A week later, it was found out that the United Nations wrongly linked global warming to natural disasters, hurricanes and other major storms. If I'd have had time, I would explain why that's the case. We've known that for years that it couldn't happen. But the IPCC put out all these reports that have been scaring the people of the world for years that there's going to be more devastating storms, hurricanes, and so forth with global warming. Totally false. That's January 24th. On January 28th, 4 days later, they found out that the section dealing with the rainforest, the Amazon rainforest, was also wrong. That was based on a report of harvesting of the Amazon rainforest. Had nothing to do with global warming. And then you come to the Alps glaciers. They say the Alps glaciers are receding faster than any time in history. And that report was made on the basis of an observation by a master's candidate interviewing hikers. Within 2 weeks, three major segments of the 2007 IPCC report were found to be totally and absolutely false. And it continues on. I'm not going to go into all of them. Those are the big ones. Now, the 2009-2010 cap and trade legislation is going to be devastating if it passes. What they're calling for is a reduction in emissions below the 2005 levels of 3% by 2012. That's only 2 years. How are we going to reduce it by 3%? Of course, it's been reduced by more than that because of the Depression, so I guess they've met that goal already. By 2020, they want to reduce it by 20%, or 17% actually. And they're going to do that by creating alternative green energy. I'll talk about that in a minute. By 2030, they're supposed to reduce it by 58%. By 2050, by 83%. Now, there is not one thing that you have in your house that you use on a daily basis or anything that is not using fossil fuels. I won't say fossil fuels. Carbon-based fuels of some sort or another. 80% of our energy is produced by coal. About 75% of our total energy is either coal, natural gas, or oil, gasoline. It's physically impossible to meet these goals. Literally. And yet there's a one-to-one ratio between our economy and fossil or carbon-based fuels, a one-to-one ratio. If we don't have carbon-based fuels, our economy goes down just as fast as the use of carbon-based fuels goes down. That's how closely tied we are. It's estimated that the cost by 2030 for increased energy costs alone, and Obama has basically said the same thing, is going to cost $3,000 per family. Now, the EPA and the CBO says, oh, it's going to cost $100 per family. That's totally wrong. Absolutely, I can't get into the details. We just don't have time. The energy cost rebate plan that they're wanting to put into place will only return $1 for every $8 spent per family. It's a false herring. It's going to cost every American family almost $5,000 per year in increased living costs. Why? Because you have to have your food transported. You have to use energy to create products, your TV, plasma TVs, and so forth. Everything is energy dependent, so if those costs go up, so does your cost of living. So now we're up to almost $8,000 per family a year. It's going to cost $700 billion per year, gross domestic product by 2030, $9.4 trillion over the next 25 years. That's the raw cost. 57% lower profits for farmers who are working usually on a razor edge anyway. Now, Spain has actually calculated the number of jobs that have been lost for every green job created. 2.2. That was by the Carlos University. The government just came out a few months ago, and it's closer to 3 to 4 jobs lost. Germany just issued a report last week that's closer to 3 to 4 jobs lost per green job created. And Italy reported last month 5 jobs lost per green job created.
Just had an article actually today in the Columbus newspaper, a green company that got all these incentives was just fined by the EPA for excessive pollution.
Right.
A green company.
It has nothing to do with protecting the environment. It has everything to do with making money. In fact, if cap and trade goes through, Gore will be probably the first billionaire off of it than anyone, before anybody else. It's estimated that 6 million jobs will be lost. I think all these numbers are very conservative. I think you could probably safely double them. That's how bad this is. It is so bad that it's unbelievable. Up to $750,000 per green job created. Is that how you want your tax money to be used? That's your future they're taking away from you right now. Green energy is a myth. Now, I'm not against solar power or wind power as much as I rail against it. I'm really not against it in its proper place. But it can never be a major source of our power. It just cannot be. Why? If you were to create enough energy to equal one coal plant, would require a mile wide of wind turbines all the way from Los Angeles to San Francisco. Just to equal one coal-generated, electrical power-generated facility. Millions of acres devoured by wind machines to equal something that's basically over less than 100 acres. Solar power is the same way. Also, the wind only blows about 27% of the time. Solar is obviously limited by sunshine and also is very inefficient at these latitudes. The sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. So where does the power come from when that happens? From coal power generator facilities, we have to have the same number of plants operating at full capacity 100% of the time in case the wind stopped blowing. That's why one of the reasons it's going to be so much more expensive, because to carry the base load, you still have to keep all this other stuff going. Right. And if you put a solar panel system on top of your roof, it's probably closer to 30 years.
Right.
And by that time, it's going to need to be replaced. There is nothing really good about it. It can never meet the base load. It has high maintenance costs. Solar costs between 12 and 35 cents per kilowatt hour. Wind is between 5 and 6 cents per kilowatt hour. It requires a vast new transmission system. And compare that to coal, which is between 2 and 4 cents per kilowatt hour. The only thing that's even close to being competitive is nuclear. And we shut our nuclear science down 40 years ago. We don't have any nuclear scientists left anymore to build these things. Well, stealing from France, I guess. France is about 70% nuclear. Works fine. Also, and I'm not going to go into this, but the EPA passed a ruling of endangerment from carbon dioxide, calling it a pollutant. On that basis, they have published 18,000 pages of new regulations to reduce the amount of carbon emissions every year. 18,000 pages. And it affects everyone from a small business upward. Now, is carbon dioxide a pollutant? Absolutely not. It's a life essential gas. We cannot have life on planet Earth without it. In fact, if the carbon dioxide levels were to double, we'd increase our cereal crops between 20 and 50%, our legume crops about 44%, our roots and tubers, potatoes, onions, carrots by 40%, and vegetables and so forth by 33%. Already, just from the increase that we've had already, they're seeing about a 12% increase in food production around the world. That's free. And here we're calling it a pollutant and taking economically destructive approaches to stop it. It's insane. It is literally, literally insane. Is man causing global warming? Not likely. We don't need cap-and-trade legislation. And if you haven't gotten one of these two videos, I would suggest that you get them. Again, this one is designed for your ages. It's also designed for adults. But it's perfect for classrooms. This one goes into the politics behind global warming as well. Both of them, I interviewed dozens of scientists and politicians and experts. It's not me talking. It's the real experts talking. And, of course, my new book is coming out here shortly, in a couple weeks. Tuesday night, just two nights ago, President Obama called for the passage of the cap-and-trade legislation in the U.S. Senate. I'm going to give you a task. When you get home, and I really implore you to do this, one of your first tasks from when you get home from this meeting is to go to nocapandtrade.us. Write it down. On that website, I have a wealth of information about the true science and also about how cap and trade not only is not necessary, but is dangerous and very punitive and is stealing your future. And I also have 12 YouTube videos, 3.5 minutes long on the average. Now, you're the generation of YouTube. What I'd like to see is these to go viral, because they really paint a picture of why cap and trade is not needed and what's wrong with it. Because we're going to be voting on this probably within a month, and we need to help the American people understand that this is wrong. This is something you can get your hands on and actually do, and it won't take much time. Write your senators. I don't care if they're green is green. Write them anyway. Your first task, and tell them that you're a high school student or wherever you are, and you've been learning about global warming and finding out that the whole thing is a fraud, and that you hope that they will not pass this cap-and-trade legislation because it will devastate our economy. That's all you need to say. Don't get long-winded. The shorter, the better. It has instructions as to where to write and so forth, too, on the website. The last thing, and I just got a couple minutes to do this, and I only need a couple minutes. We've talked about what's happening, we've talked about how did it happen, and we're going to talk about taking back America now. Now, what Larry Pratt talked about this morning, assuming or getting back our states' rights, is key to this process. I'm not going to go into that again. However, in every national law, in almost every state law, you'll have language like this in the law. Nobody has taken advantage of it until a few years ago. In the NEPA laws, the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, it says the Congress recognizing profound impact of man's activity on the interrelationships of all components of the national environment declares that it is the continuing policy of the federal government in cooperation with state and local governments. Any kind of elected government, it could be your school board, and other concerned public and private organizations fulfill the social, economic, and other requirements of present and future generations of America. Now, the key words in here is cooperation. That's a legal expression. And we got the other concerned public and private organizations, but more than anything else, local governments has the best standing in any litigation of this. Local governments can be involved. It goes on to say that it's the continuing responsibility of the federal government to use all practicable means, another legal expression, consistent with other essential considerations and national policy to improve and coordinate. Coordinate is even a stronger word than cooperate. Federal plans, functions, programs, and resources to the end that the nation may preserve important historic, cultural, natural aspects of our national heritage and maintain wherever possible an environment which supports diversity and a variety of individual choice. Practicable means that the federal government has to go through as many hoops as necessary to conform their policy with a local policy. They have to coordinate any laws that they impose on a local community with the local community. Now, they never have because the local communities have never asked to be involved because they didn't know. Cultural, powerful, powerful legal expression. What is your culture for your community? If the federal government and its federal law and the regulations that are developing for your area violate your cultural area, you can stop it dead in its tracks, and I'll give you an example in a minute. And it has to maintain individual choice. Now, none of these have been met in the past. It's always the federal government steamrolling over the local community because the local community had no clue they have a horse in the race. They can actually compete with the federal government. Under NEPA and federal state laws, when required by NEPA, governments must strongly consider how the federal action will affect the local culture and customs as defined by the local government. Not by the federal government, but by the local government. Strongly consider the effects on the physical environment. For example, how it affects farming, cattle, ranching, best management practices, and so forth, fishing and other natural resources. It has to consider the economic consequences. Federal government's never done that. Strongly consider the economy and the effect on the tax base to the local government. It's never done that in the past. Seriously consider local solutions and alternatives to the federal proposals. They're required to by federal law. They have never done it in the past because no one's ever challenged them on it. And consider mitigation if necessary. This is powerful stuff. Now, there are three classes of cooperation within the federal government. You can be a commenting agency, where they take your comments and throw them in the round file. Or you can be a cooperative agency. Now, in some places, it's worked. But most cases, you have the ability to voice your concerns and so forth, but the final decision still rests with the federal government. But if you apply for coordination, coordinating agency, the local government is a full partner in the process and final decision that the federal government makes for your local community. And you can stop them dead in their tracks. It's been done by dozens, hundreds of local communities now. How is it done? Citizens create a local advisory committee for whatever agency. It could be the county. We're going to use county level for this example, but it could be done with your school district, your water district, any elected agency or government in your area. The purpose is to develop and recommend, you do not have legal authority in itself, a local management plan for whatever it is the federal government's trying to do. You take it to the county commissioners. The county commissioners appoint an advisor, you as advisory committee, a group of people representing the community. You have to have environmentalists involved as well. The advisory committee takes input for the first plan, and it's not a comprehensive zoning plan. The advisory committee writes the first plan, gives it back to the county commissioners, it could be any level of government, and they review it. They send it back to the committee for modification. The committee makes modifications, takes it back to the commission. They accept the plan by resolution and then they take it out to the public for public comment. And it'll go through the cycle several times. Finally, the county or whatever government will pass the ordinance. And once that's done, the federal government has to take it into consideration. They have to write a letter asking to be considered as a coordinating agency. There's a lot of legal steps. There are exact procedures to follow. And if you don't follow them, you'll be ignored. However, the counties and other agencies that have applied for this procedure have been extremely, extremely effective in protecting their citizens. Unbelievable. If I had 2 hours, I'd tell you some of the stories. It does work. I want to tell you one story that just happened this past year. You might have remembered your parents talking about the North American Union and the NAFTA superhighway. This is it. This is what they were proposing. A series of major quarter-mile-wide highways traversing the United States from southern Mexico to northern Canada and Alaska. The first one was to go through Texas. It was part of the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. It got the nickname North America Union because it was tailored after the European Union's plans. It's called the Trans-Texas Corridor. It was 6 football fields wide. It was being leased to a Spanish company called Cintra. It had already been leased. Billions had changed hands already, billions of dollars. And Cintra was going to build this and lease it from Texas for 100 years. These are called public-private partnerships. I'm not going to go into that, but they're deadly too. Anyway, some friends of mine who are involved in this coordination process in Texas, had their offices in Texas, got a half a dozen local communities. One was a school district, one was a water district. Very small, basically powerless governmental agencies. And they stood right in the way of this behemoth. Tens of billions of dollars involved. President Bush was involved. The Texas governor was involved pushing this thing. Literally, billions of dollars were forcing this way through. And they stopped it, dead in its tracks, using the coordination process. It does work. It really does. You have more power in your local community than you think you do, but it will require a lot of hard work because you have people that want to just roll right over the top of you. And those who are involved in this committee are going to have to spend hundreds of hours a year doing this. But let me tell you, the satisfaction of being able to stand up to a multinational consortium that's trying to plow through your area and put you under the dirt and win is a tremendous feeling. You can do it. And this is really what I hope I want to give in this book, of outlining what's happening, who did it, but how we can act to be able to take back our nation. It's a slow process. It won't happen overnight, but we've got to start this November. Any questions?
Can we go back to one of the first slides about the ice core, the ice core graph?
Yeah.
Please?
This one?
I think so. Yeah. With this graph, you agree that you like the approximate accuracy of science that's on the
ground? Approximate. I would not hold my breath over it. The only thing I can really say is, as a trend, is probably not bad. Obviously, you cannot measure the temperature exactly. So, with that qualification, yeah, I will accept what they have provided at face value.
Even back to the dates, as far back as they
as 450,000 years to 650,000. Yeah, it's probably accurate only in the sense that you will not find this air moving out of those little air bubbles. I'm making that assumption. Everybody else is making that assumption. It has yet to be proven, but yet it seems to be fairly consistent.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, enjoy your skits. I enjoyed being here.
To get a copy of this presentation complete with the PowerPoint slides in video format, you can go to www.campamerican.com. That's campamerican.com. And both parts of the lecture are available for purchase at that website. Go to the store. And we ask that you would join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.